to hopefully broaden the number of folks who could be covered. The intervention should not create risks and cost shifting that would lead effective and responsible providers to withdraw from the public delivery system, or worse, to go out of business. Next slide, please. Before I comment on the pharmaceutical strategy specifically, I wish to address recommendation number 17, which calls for expanded cost-effective disease management approaches. I have been particularly interested in this topic with specific emphasis on the use of the chronic care model in improving the treatment of depression. I'm currently participating in a highly successful national project to integrate the use of this model, which is a disease-focused strategy funded through the Federal Health Resources Services Administration. The model utilizes a systematic improvement strategy that provides effective, evidence-based decision support to providers, cost-effective allocation of clinical tasks with emphasis on the use of care monitors, meaningful client education and goal setting, improved and contemporaneous information systems which make tracking patient progress and outcomes more manageable, easy-to-use quality improvement processes, and active solicitation of community supports. There is substantial evidence that this approach will work in providing much better care to the selected populations who have chronic health problems. And I would add, I'm working with SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration at the federal level, the Center for Mental Health Services, to consider applying the same model to working with folks with severe and persistent mental illness in community-based mental health programs. These patients currently utilize an enormous amount of care in primary care and specialty delivery systems. This is the kind of cost containment intervention that will take some time to fully develop and spread throughout our service systems, but which will, in the long run, provide some of the most promising and sustainable savings. The only caution I would interject is that the emphasis should be on ultimately helping local provider organizations develop the use of such methods.
It may be necessary. Ask a question.
Sure.
Representative Tillman.
Thank you. Going back, my mind works a little bit slower than you talk.
I'm sorry.
But I'm back. That's fine. I'm trying to follow it also as I'm reading what you're saying. I'm going back to depression. It seems to me that we've heard just recently that most primary physicians treat depression. Most depression is treated by primary physicians. Is that correct?
Chairman Westland and Representative Tomai, I think the way to ask that question is who is treating depression and how much depression is there. We know that there's a lot of depression of different kinds and that probably the vast majority of treatment for depression is provided through primary care offices. And the vast majority of antidepressant medications are being prescribed by primary care providers, probably over 70% in terms of the Medicaid pharmaceutical tracking of antidepressant medications
So if that's the case, how does this model work?
This model that I'm describing?
Right.
It works with primary care clinics. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. The chronic care model that I'm working with the Health Resources Services Administration on is working with community health clinics, rural health clinics, primary care clinics for the most part, to try to bring mental health providers and substance abuse providers into those clinics and to help to redesign the delivery system so they can be better capable of identifying and treating, in some cases, mental health problems like depression, in this case, and to know when and how to refer some of those patients to specialty care, either within their clinic when they have specialists who are there, either master's level clinicians or psychiatrists or other prescribing providers who have mental health expertise, or to community-based mental health programs. Okay. What I was referring to in terms of the severe and persistent mental ill population, or the folks with those illnesses, is one could apply the same methodology to working with folks with illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in terms of some of the specific evidence-based supports, information system design, and quality improvement design that have been developed as part of this chronic care model. There's a group called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that is kind of working with HRSA to do this project. I'm on the faculty for it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go on to your next section on medication, what you've just talked about sounds a little bit to me like what we were hearing about Multnomah County's reworked system a couple days ago. I don't know if you're familiar with that system, and if you are, how does that, does that fit into what you're talking about, or do you see them as going a different direction from your concept of a disease management approach?
It's hard to answer that. In a sense, Chairman Westland and Representative Merkley, the chronic care model has been developed primarily for chronic physical illnesses, and it's now just being applied to psychiatric illnesses like depression. So it's mainly been applied to diabetes and asthma and cardiovascular disease. Now, the interesting thing is, as I've shared with my community psychiatric colleagues around the country, this concept, they're saying, oh, we've been doing this in community mental health for a long time. The only difference is that in community-based programs, we haven't been doing as rigorous an attention to some of the outcomes and patient registry activities and so forth. What has been done in Multnomah County parallels this in some ways. It really parallels what I and Bob Nickel and others have been saying needs to be done in community-based systems. We have to provide the services where the clients or patients are. That means the mobile outreach teams that were developed in Multnomah County, the centralized one-stop shop in terms of the call-in center, the dispersed urgent walk-in clinics that were developed, as well as the attention to providing more case management to getting people out into the community. The chronic care model that's being applied in these community health clinics doesn't really involve a lot of outreach. It does involve redesigning how things are done in those clinics to work with those folks. And in this case, we're talking about folks who have less severe psychiatric conditions like depression. But these community-based health clinics are serving folks who have many times no insurance or they're on Medicaid, and they often have significant comorbid problems like substance use and anxiety disorders and other problems. So they tend to be complex as well. So I guess the bottom line is there are parallels, but they're not exactly the same. It's a new territory now to consider applying some of this to the way we've been doing services for folks with severe and persistent mental illness, although it's not entirely alien to what's been done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think I will just continue, if that's okay. The comments I want to make now have to do with the caution about how we apply a disease management model. It may be necessary to have a centralized or statewide organization in the early stages, such as is being provided in some of the disease management arrangements we're doing here in Oregon.
David?
Yes.
Excuse me. For the benefit of the committee, give us a, 101 definition of disease management.
There might, Chairman Westland, this involves a focused approach that takes a particular diagnosis, like asthma or diabetes or in the mental health area, depression, and says, we think there are ways that one could provide clear decision support for providers that gives them, say, algorithms about what kinds of questions they need to address in diagnosing that condition and what kind of steps they may need to take in providing the proper treatment. First, you might wait in the case of a low-level depression. You may not use medications. Or later on, you might use a particular type of medication. You wait X period of time, 2-4 weeks. They also use certain screening instruments. In the case of depression, there's a screening instrument called the PHQ, Patient Health Questionnaire, that's 9 questions. It really is fairly sensitive to identifying folks who are at risk of depression. And then you can use that same instrument on a serial basis to identify whether they're getting better. And using that kind of approach, one would monitor in a systematic way whether you're getting improvement. And then having a patient registry in which you track those folks who you have, in a sense, identified as having this or that condition and have certain benchmarks that you would think about both in terms of individual patients as well as aggregates of patients. We want to have X percent of our patients who have this condition achieve this level of improvement by this period of time. If you have those kinds of benchmarks and you're not achieving them, then you might use quality improvement approaches to figure out why that's not happening. So there's really kind of a nice synergistic approach of these 6 elements that I described in making that kind of approach work. Now, there's disease management programs that are provided by some companies that involve providing some of these services kind of as a consultation or a proffered approach that could be, in a sense, sold to or bought for a provider organization. So, for example, McKesson, which is doing some of that for this state, is providing some of this kind of care monitoring in a centralized way. My only caution about that is that we really want to transfer this kind of ability to those local organizations and clinics so they can really learn how to do it themselves, if at all possible. But maybe some of them may have problems in being too sparsely populated or not high enough of an aggregate of providers in their clinic to do it, or too under-resourced to do it. And that's the main point I was making at the end of that section.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Hi, David. Good to see you again, by the way.
Hi.
Did you understand that explanation? Was that, I mean, I could give you a simpler answer to that that I think might make more sense to you. It's the kind of thing that we do every day. I mean, that's, algorithms and all that stuff is tough to grasp sometimes when you're not doing it every day. But another explanation would be for the treatment of, say, asthma. We have an algorithm, which means basically a cookbook. It says the first time a patient comes in and they're at, and they're wheezing and they're asthmatic, you don't put them on a very heavy-duty drug. With a series of drugs, 1, 2, 3, 4, you work your way through to get the patient better. But what we quite frankly find out there in the real field, is, as you are aware, people are all over the map on the treatment. Some physicians will start with one, some will start with another, even though we've done good studies to show the best outcomes are attained by following the plan. And
The cookbook.
And physicians avoid that. They don't like the idea of being told how to practice medicine. Well, I mean, in fact, in many cases, they get better results long-term for a large number of people if they follow that. And it's been something that physicians have, quite frankly, been difficult to work with on. But in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen people start to move towards outcome-based medicine. That is basically, to a certain degree, with some caveats in their cookbook medicine. Follow the best practices and do it every time for that patient with that diagnosis, and you'll get better results. I think that's what you're talking about.
Chairman Westland and Representative Bates, you're absolutely correct. You said it in a much clearer, succinct way than I could have.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Bacovian appreciated that simplistic. I mean, yeah, I was following along, no problem, but Rick needed that. Thank you.
One point in relation to that that Representative Bates is alluding to, and it was alluded to in the previous hearing that at least a couple of you were in, is that the work by Jack Wenberg at Dartmouth has pointed out this terrible variation in the types of treatments that are provided for a whole range of conditions. And part of the rationale of doing these algorithms is to narrow the variations in treatment and make them more in relation to what we think evidence supports. One of the problems for providers in this world in the 21st century, in the latter part of the 20th century, is the information explosion. There's just way more information than any human being can possibly encompass and keep under his or her head. So having this kind of support, even though it feels like a cookbook, is really useful. If we can go on, now to the specific medication recommendations. At the tail end of the attachment C, the first six of the Tier 2 recommendations in the report relate to pharmaceutical cost savings. Rather than review each of these suggestions, I will brief the committee on the recent activities of a combined team from our office and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. We've been considering a wide range of interventions that directly and indirectly address medication access and utilization. Most of the Tier 2 suggestions are included in the strategies we have been considering. We brought together a group of stakeholders, including providers and advocates. In that group, we collected the best thinking of those participants and created a list of potential interventions. We're now in the process of costing out and reviewing the feasibility of each of these proposed interventions. We intend to return to a representative group of stakeholders to review our interim suggestions. However, we wanted to brief you today on this process so that you could be as much up-to-date as possible on the initiative. Next slide, please. Hey, we're on track. That's great. Our office is committed to... actually, back up one. There we go. Our office is committed to two general principles for medication management. First, we want to preserve a benefit for those who are most in need, and to do so with the least disruption to the service system. It is important to keep in mind that the vast majority of psychiatric medications are prescribed by primary care providers, as Representative Tomei noticed. But that some misuse and overuse of medications also occurs within the practice of the prescribing providers in the community mental health system. The approaches we develop must be tailored to each of these groups and their respective prescribing tendencies. We intend to do this first through a decision support approach that relies on voluntary measures before using mandatory interventions. This can be accomplished through prior and retrospective advice before prior authorization mechanisms would be required. This rationale derives...
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So the mandatory interventions would be prior authorization?
Representative Westland, Chairman Westland and Representative Tomei, prior authorization depends on how you define it. We're using the term prior advice, which is more or less what the Medicaid office is doing now.
So what do you mean by mandatory interventions then?
A mandatory intervention would be one in which a physician would get called or would have to call or his or her office would have to call to get prior approval before a medication could be prescribed and
is that
authorized.
Different from prior authorization?
That is prior authorization.
Okay.
Although prior authorization is a term that is sometimes used more loosely, and some people may include this concept of prior advice, this kind of educational
right.
approach that is more voluntary.
Right.
And in fact, there's a fair amount of data to show that prior advice can have a significant impact on shaping prescriber practices and attitudes. And we will use data systems to track how that works.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This rationale derives in part from the justifiable concern of the advocacy community. Clients and family members of those with mental health and addiction disorders are worried that their access to essential medications will be curtailed. Stigma and historical discrimination against persons with such disorders lend credence to such fears. Additionally, there's a growing body of evidence that limiting access to psychiatric medications simply as a narrow cost-conscious strategy has dramatic cost impacts on other aspects of the healthcare system, not to mention costs that are tied to loss of productivity, criminal justice involvement, and social disruption, all associated with poorly treated major mental illness and addictive disorders. Second, we wish to emphasize quality improvement through progressive delivery system redesign. This means development and implementation of consultation, collaboration, and integration. For the primary care system, this means increased access to psychiatric experts for consultation on diagnosis and prescribing, as well as integrating various mental health and addiction specialists into primary care settings for improved access and treatment. This is an area that I've worked on a lot over the last 15 years. For the mental health system, it means introducing and disseminating very broadly evidence-based psychiatric prescribing methods, such as those developed in the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, in a sense, a cookbook that Representative Bates was referring to. In both systems, mental health and primary care, we need to emphasize the use of less expensive medications and prescribing approaches that will still achieve acceptable clinical benefit and responsiveness to patient needs and desires. For the past year, we've supported three local medication-related projects, our office has, local or regional partnerships of mental health organizations and fully capitated health plans have explored ways of improving psychiatric medication utilization and cost containment while maintaining quality of care. The data from these projects is still being analyzed, but the preliminary findings support many of the specific recommendations that follow and have informed our efforts with local experience. The three projects ended up using different approaches that respectively conform to the first three sets of strategies that I'm listing in the next three slides. Next slide, please. The first set of strategies relates to increasing accountability. And you can follow these bullets and I'll give you more detail. Use of pharmaceutical utilization data to identify outlier prescribing providers, but to make this more relatively local to account for those providers who have a high proportion of higher acuity or severity patients, something we call adverse selection. Such providers can be offered appropriate consultation and academic detailing if they are indeed outliers, meaning their prescribing practices are out of the standard of the rest of the community or what we think evidence-based practices would support. Improve data systems to make medication utilization information, both patient-focused and provider-focused, more accurate, complete, and contemporaneous, and available system-wide, but within confidentiality limits. You might be surprised, maybe not, to know that in our Medicaid pharmaceutical data system, there are about 30% of the prescribing providers or prescriptions that we have that we're tracking that we don't know who the prescribing person was. We'd like to change things to improve that if at all possible. We'd like to improve things so that all the clinicians know what other medications other clinicians are prescribing. If prior advice or authorization mechanisms are to be used, we need to make sure that the system is adequately and clinically competently staffed to assure responsiveness, efficiency, and credibility. Many of the consumers and their families have complained that their providers or their prescribers have been frustrated by the lack of expertise in the folks that they've had to deal with over the phone or the time it takes to get a response. This has to be fixed, and we have to do this in order to assure adequate prescribing provider cooperation. We need to introduce polypharmacy reduction interventions. In the area of psychiatry, there are at least three practices that we know we can save money on. One is to reduce the use of people being on two atypical antipsychotic medications at any one time, two selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that's a newer antidepressant medication, at any one time, or more than four psychotropic medications of any class at any one time. We need to provide targeted medication utilization reviews, particularly in residential, congregate care, and nursing care programs. Polypharmacy and excessive and inappropriate use of psychotropic medications are fairly common in these types of facilities, and we can probably capture a fair amount of savings by focusing on those. The next slide focuses on a set of strategies that are related to delivery system design. We need to increase, possibly, the consultation opportunities between psychiatrists and primary care providers. We need to increase mental health and primary care collaboration and integration for longer-term impact on primary care prescribing patterns and increased access of those primary care patients to mental health and addiction providers. It's well known that primary care providers have as many as 30% to 50% or more of their patients have some significant comorbid or primary psychiatric problem that brings them into service in that clinic, or they're reluctant to go to the mental health clinic for one reason or another. We need to increase all prescribing providers' ability to know what medications mutually shared patients are receiving from all other prescribing providers. This will decrease the risk of inadvertent polypharmacy and drug interactions, which could be harmful to a person's health. It should also contribute to improved communications between providers. We should utilize some streamlined prescriber-initiated protocols for pharmacists and nursing staff to implement. For example, a tapering schedule for withdrawing a person who is on benzodiazepines, a minor tranquilizer, and needs to be withdrawn from them. Or the standard titration of medications like lithium for someone who has a bipolar disorder and needs to be started on that medication, if and only if there's appropriate and proper oversight by a prescribing provider for that kind of protocol. We need to increase the availability of certain cost-effective psychosocial interventions that may diminish the need for more expensive medications. We need to develop and spread the use of patient education programs, including those conducted by consumers, to increase patient knowledge and to increase the likelihood that patients would adhere to medications and their treatments. At the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, where I used to be the medical director during the previous 2 or 3 years, a group of consumers has been developing with the staff at that mental health organization just this kind of educational program and using consumers to provide a fair amount of the training. We need to develop and spread the use of care monitoring, as has been mentioned by me in the chronic care model, to facilitate patient understanding and adherence, as well as communication between the patient and the prescribing provider. Next slide. The third set of strategies involves medication-specific interventions, and these have gotten a lot of attention, but I want you to understand that the whole range of strategies I'm mentioning here will bring in a lot of savings, and we aren't focusing exclusively on these. We need to increase dosing efficiency. This involves encouraging the use of less frequent dosing, for example, once-a-day doses, of larger and less expensive pill sizes. It's well known that most medications are less expensive on a cost-per-milligram basis, meaning a 100-milligram pill of Zoloft costs almost the same as a 50-milligram pill of Zoloft. So it makes sense, if a patient is on 50 milligrams a day of Zoloft, to have, if he or she is capable of breaking the pills or cutting them in half, and sometimes these pills are scored so they're easily divided in half, to have them have 100 milligram pills and take a 50 milligram portion of a pill once a day. Now, we would only do this for people who are capable of handling this and who want to do it, not to force people to have pill splitting as part of their approach. This is also consistent with the principle of less frequent doses being more compatible with patient adherence to treatment. Well, I'm sorry, I was talking about pill splitting, and that's the second bullet. The same principle applies to this notion of more frequent dosing going to less frequent dosing. You may have someone on a medication like risperidone, which is an atypical antipsychotic medication. A 1 milligram pill 4 times a day doesn't make sense, but sometimes we see that. A person could be on 4 milligrams, and that pill is much close to the same cost as a 1 milligram pill, and take it once a day because the half-life of that medication is such that once-a-day dosing would work for that particular medication. The next, the third bullet is to use generic or less expensive medications when initiating treatment, especially with antidepressants. There are several newer antidepressant medications that are available or soon to be available in generic form. There's good evidence that using the generic forms of these medications is safe and effective as a first step in treating many patients with new episodes of illness, especially if the prescribing provider can opt to use other medications if there is sufficient justification to do so, such as a prior family history of response to another medication or other complicating health problems. I might point out here that we are not recommending the use of less expensive in relation to the atypical antipsychotic medications, and at the same time, we think cost consciousness has to come into consideration of any prescribing, but I'm not referring to atypical antipsychotics in this particular point. It does also apply to certain other classes of psychiatric medications like minor tranquilizers. There are generic forms of some of the benzodiazepines that are just as effective as the brand names. Another approach will be to dispense smaller numbers of pills on the first prescription, especially for more expensive medications for chronic conditions. For example, a 1 or 2 week supply instead of a month supply. We often find that patients choose not to take the medications they were given. We'd rather have them flush down the toilet 1 week's worth of medications than 4 weeks' worth of medications, and then find out that they didn't like that medication and try something else. The common problem of non-adherence that I'm addressing here is, as I'm saying, fairly common. The selective application of this intervention to more expensive medications would mitigate the slight increase in pharmaceutical dispensing fees that may occur. Finally, in this category, to introduce medication algorithms and practice decision support mechanisms, such as the Texas Medication Algorithm Project's guidelines that I referred to earlier. The final group of strategies is system-focused. These include some that you're familiar with in your recommendations. Transfer the funding and risk for pharmaceutical benefit management of mental health medications to local provider organizations. This may involve regionalizing management of services rather than administering it through a statewide organization. To include all Medicaid patients in the pharmaceutical benefit management program, even if they are not currently in other managed care provider systems or if they're a fee-for-service client. We have significant fraction of patients in fee-for-service because of lack of managed care providers in their county or because they opt out of managed care. Entering into bulk purchasing arrangements for the state to purchase mental health medications, but only if doing so would reduce pharmaceutical prices more than the current discount and rebate arrangements provide. Including some classes of psychiatric medications into the physician managed prescription drug program. This is a very controversial action and should only be done after considering all other options, and even then with due consideration of the importance of sufficient access to necessary medications for persons with the more severe psychiatric disorders. So in summary, I wish to thank you for this opportunity to comment on your substantial work and to present the cost containment and systems improvement ideas that we're currently considering. I'd be glad to answer any additional questions that the chairman or other members may have.
David, thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Rep. March. I'm particularly interested in sort of the kind of the last bullet there. And you've been in this business 23 years, you say, so. Tell us what drugs were being used for, say, something like schizophrenia in 1980 versus 2003?
Chairman Westlin and Representative March, the older generation of antipsychotic medications was still in vogue in the late 70s and early 80s. It was in the mid-80s, I believe, that the first newer antipsychotic medication, clozapine, which is the brand name of it, is Clozaril, came online. Those medications were drugs like originally what were called phenothiazines. Thorazine, chlorpromazine was the first one, really, and that was introduced in the late 50s. And then came others of that class of medications, stelazine and Melaril and some other ones. And then we had some additional new classes in the sense that they were different molecular structure. Haloperidol, Haldol, and Prolixin were some of the ones that gained prominence, partly because those two medications could be given in an injectable form that would last a period of weeks and would be useful for some patients who were not able to or willing to comply or adhere to the medication because it's an unpleasant experience because of the side effects that a lot of these medications have. So the improvements that came with the newer classes of medications in particular had to do with the fact that in many cases they had fewer of what were the unpleasant neurological side effects, the neuromuscular stiffness and shaking and other involuntary movements that were associated with those medications. Additionally, we discovered that some of these newer medications, clozapine being the first one, and then the newer ones being olanzapine, which is known as Zyprexa in its trade name, risperidone, risperidol is the brand name, Seroquel, which is quetiapine is the chemical name for it, and geodone, ziprasidone is the chemical name for that one. I may be leaving one or two out. But these newer medications, especially clozapine, have been shown to improve what were called the positive symptoms of psychotic illness, meaning, they were useful in not only improving the positive symptoms, which are the hallucinations and the delusions and some of the agitation that are characteristic symptoms of some of the psychotic disorders, but they were also, in some cases, helpful in removing or reducing some of the, quote, negative symptoms. And by that, I mean the lack of initiative, the passivity, and some of the other problems that some of these patients tended to manifest. So that we had the equivalent of awakenings in some patients. They were able to resume productive activity and become more functional and have much better quality of life with some of these newer medications. Now, granted, there are still some folks who do well and would prefer to stay on some of the older medications. They're just not being used as much. And I think most psychiatrists would agree the older antipsychotic medications would not be considered the first line of medication these days.
How are... when you're, if you're using an algorithms type approach where you are basing it on prior experience, how do you adapt and interject new medications into that system?
Well, these algorithmic approaches and consensus reviews that different groups are doing, and I have a copy of the Texas Medication Algorithm Project here somewhere I could show you. It's kind of like Representative Bates was showing. It's kind of a stepwise fashion. They're being reviewed by experts and getting new scientific data all the time to modify those. Just as in the Oregon Health Plan, the Health Services Commission has been modifying the prioritized list over the last 12 years using new information from evidence that we have. I'm on the Mental Health and Chemical Dependency Subcommittee of that commission, by the way. Scientific evidence is used to adjust these kinds of guidelines, both the ones that the American Psychiatric Association has developed as well as others that for example, this Texas Medication Project has done.
So it would be slowly worked into the sort of the bottom of the list, sort of,
well,
so to speak.
Well, it's not really working at the bottom of the list. Some of the things are like first step you would use, For depression, for example, an SSRI, serotonin reuptake inhibitor medication. Well, some of the newer antidepressants came online, like Effexor and Wellbutrin, bupropion. And now some of the treatment algorithms say you can use any of these newer antidepressant medications. And the fact that we now have at least two that are generic, Prozac or fluoxetine and bupropion, what's been sold as both Wellbutrin and Zyban, because it's also been useful in reducing craving of cigarettes and tobacco dependence. Those are both available generically, and there may be some justification in saying, well, those would both be drugs that might be worth trying first before one would try a more expensive one. And we know that another one will be coming online as a generic in the next several months, and that's Celexa, citalopram is the chemical name. So one would adjust what the list of recommendation of medications it might use at different stages in this cookbook approach based on new information. So you could always modify it. It's electronic, so it's easy to do.
Thank you.
Any other questions for David?
Thank you, Murray, very much, sir.
Thank you for your attention.
We will study this with great interest. Also, we have today with us Gene Cohn, who's going to come up and testify on the importance of comprehensive mental health and addiction treatment for ethnic minority women and their families. Gene, if you've got someone else, yeah, enter and sign in, please. And like I told David, get real friendly with those mics.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Cohen, and I'm the director of Project Network at Legacy Health System. And actually, I have worked in the mental health field as long as David. I remember him at my first job. My work has been focused in Northeast Portland. I just want to tell you a little bit about Project Network. We have passed out some packets, and then I'm going to let the consumers talk about what they've gotten out of having comprehensive treatment and maybe where they'd be without it. We've been in existence 14 years. We treat women and children, pregnant women, and we also like to treat women before they get pregnant. And those are some of the OHP standards that may be affected in the next go-around, or are affected in this go-around. We have had 5 research grants from SAMHSA, so we're always working on how to really better the model and how to really take a family approach. And one thing we really realize is that you need the continuum. You need residential, you need aftercare, sometimes you need to restabilize. And what we're developing now is peer services that are integrated with our program. And really, I want to leave it up to these three women who are all at Project Network in different stages and all OHP standard, and telling you their stories.
Hi, my name is Terry Morgan, and I'm a consumer at Project Network. And I've been in treatment, and without this treatment, I've learned to become a better parent. I've learned how to problem solve because it's a dual diagnosis and I'm a depressed person. You know, I've been able to get stable on my medication since then. I've been given, I've become more independent. I'm work ready, that I don't have to be a burden on the state. I also have a disabled child who, if I hadn't got some help for myself, she would be a burden on the state as well. You know, I foresee that if these services weren't available, and I also have a lifeline that I'm in the process right now of transitioning out, and I'm just really thankful. I would like to keep a lifeline right there just until I can just get all the way, you know, stable. And I feel like the outpatient services is really going to be necessary for me in the future, something I can rely on. I heard him talk about the medications and stuff, and I'm on some of that. And it's dwindling down to where I don't have to be on a heavy dose of medication anymore, you know, and it seems to be working for me. But without this, I feel like that I would be really tangled back very deep down in the system. I feel like my children would be in the system, and I feel like the taxpayers would be paying for all of this. And today, by the grace of God that we have this program right here, I've been able to manage to be ready to go back to work and stay and keep my family out of the system. And the cost to the state would be larger if you guys cut these services. Then, I mean, it's just almost devastating to think of the count that you guys would have on, you know, what would happen, you know, and the safety for the community, you know. Right now, you know, I'm learning to be real respectful in my community. I'm learning to be really law-abiding. I'm just really, you know, and I feel safe in it. But without these services to some of the people that I've seen out there, it could be pretty scary. And I just like to see this continue because this brought me a mighty long way.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Jerry, for your testimony. Jerry, tell me how long you've been involved in the system and here at Project Network and how you got involved.
I've been in there 5.5 months. And without this, I'd probably be in jail somewhere or in the crazy house somewhere or something misplaced.
How did you get involved, Jerry?
I got referred. Well, first off, I didn't even know I was depressed for a while there, and I had a bout where I almost committed suicide in one while. I had became ill, and I knew I had some depression behind that, you know, and so I end up getting referred to this agency here, you know. I knew I needed some kind of help because I kept falling and stumbling on the same stumbling blocks, you know. Since I have gotten some treatment. I got some treatment a little while earlier before, but then since I've gotten this treatment, I know that I need this treatment, and I know that it keeps me safe, you know, and so that's how I got involved with it, yeah. Through a caseworker that helped me kind of get directed, because I really, with my doctor, my physician has kind of helped me, and this program is like right in my community. It's kind of, and my doctor referred me to it, works real closely with Project Network, and he's just been a heck of a support to me. I mean, really, I call him Dr. Welby, but that's how I got there.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Liza Mikes, and I am currently a client at Project Network. And what I want to first start speaking on is the mental health issues for A&D. You know, I had started using drugs when I was 21. So I've been in and out of the system, back and forth, back and forth. Not knowing once that I had I went and talked to a doctor, and me and the doctor sat down and we talked, and he expressed some different things, concerns regarding me, and that was I have depression, severe depression. The medication that I am on is Zoloft. The same thing that the gentleman spoke on. And the Zoloft gets you to where you're on a fight or flight. Sometimes you get to a level to where you just don't want to be bothered and someone kind of ticks you off and you just take off. What the Zoloft does, it kind of levels you out to where you can just stop and be rational and thinking. The other part of it is the A&D part because of my drug addiction. What they do is we learn, and what we're being taught in there as far as women with our children is that what we have is a disease, and that the disease that we have is ongoing. It never goes away. It can be arrested at some point, but it doesn't go away. But what we learn to do is we learn to take the negative out of that and apply some positive with it. We even have women there. And me, myself, my child is not there. Because of my relapse, my son is in Anchorage, Alaska, with my sister, by the grace of God, that my children didn't get into CSD custody. My daughter is in Tacoma, Washington, so therefore, neither one of my children are with me, and they accepted me in the program. However, there is women in the program with their children, babies there together, and they're learning how to put the babies and the mothers together to reunite them and give us some kind of structure to build a foundation on. The services that has been provided for each and every one of the women in Project Network has been a really true credit to help us out. The structure, it gives us back our self-esteem. We learn how to be pro-social individuals. We learn how to work with the community. We learn how to know that the decisions and the thoughts that goes through our minds and the thoughts and the way and our behaviors, there's consequences in regards to them. So what we're taught and what we learn is that for every individual that comes in and thinks that life is just easy to where they can just, like I have, lived on the means of others by stealing and doing different things, it's not like that. You can always live in a structured life. You can always build up and grow and have different things that you need. And a lot of reasons why people go off, okay, I'll say this, a lot of reasons why I have went off and gotten loaded with drugs is because of deep-rooted issues inside of me that I have just totally blocked out. What I'm learning is to face those issues. What I'm learning is to bring them up. We have caring women. We got a group of counselors there that just help, and they're absolutely wonderful. There's a lot of individuals out on the streets right now still in the drug addiction, still running around, and they have these mental health issues and very much are unaware of it. And if you cut any of these programs, what's going to happen is that you're going to have a lot of people out there on the streets, mental ill people, drug addicted, heroin addicts. You're going to have them out there running around on the streets. And the next thing that's going to happen is that they're going to start going into different people's houses. There's going to be a lot of different things that's going to go about, you know. And with programs such as Project Network, what I said before is what they help us to do is to build our lives back up. We definitely need to look at this because any normal person wouldn't go out and just take some drugs and just deal with and do drugs like we do. You know what I'm saying? Nobody's going to walk up to anybody on the street and say, can I get a heart attack or can I have a seizure? Because this is what the drugs do to us, all right? Once that we are given this knowledge of what goes on inside of us and our health, and they're helping us to establish ourselves back into the community, then it definitely does make a difference. They give us, we're on the line of job search, resume, they help us with housing, they help us with schooling, because there's a lot of young women in there that just stopped going to school. So there's about like 8 different women in there that's going right now every morning on Saturday morning to school to get their GEDs. They're building us up. They're going to love us until we learn how to love ourselves. And this is what's so important about it. You know, it's not easy, but my worst day inside Project Network is way better than the worst day that I had being out there on the streets. Both of my children are away from me, which never has been away from me. And we had went over to the elderly care, and I seen the way the elderly were talking about their medication and how they're getting cut, the budget's getting cut. And both my parents passed away, you know, and my mom had told me that she said it was one point in time, it's going to come a time where people are going to be dying on the streets. It's going to be things cut. It's going to be people out there with no homes, nowhere to go. And this kind of looks just like what she had been telling me. You know, and if I had the power and if I could do anything in this world to help an individual out, I would let them at least be able to find out what's inside of them and what's happening and what's going on. You don't just lock a person up and then tell them you're just going to do the rest of these years in jail and not try to figure out what's going on. We even have children coming up, and for us to be in the situations that we're in, we got to have something to build our babies up on. And we don't have money. We're not working, but we can get provided with good jobs and be able to pay for our medical and dental bills and stuff like that. Then it would help out a lot. I take Imitrax because I get migraine headaches real bad. 9 Imitrax cost me $160. Project Network has worked it out to where we can get a co-payment to where I only pay $15.
Well, that's when the medication was reinstated.
That's right. And
a heart attack.
Yes, a very high. Yeah, and what I want to say is I would appreciate it truly if you would honestly just take a look at it. We got kids coming up, children behind us, and everything would work out because they need role models, you know, and somebody's got to be there for the children because it's the children that's going to make our future. You know, the children that we have. And I definitely don't want my son to end up in jail. And I definitely don't want my daughter to. I want to break the cycle. and I'm getting the chance to do that. And I would appreciate it very, very much if you would honestly sit back and consider what is really going to happen and what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions?
No. Mr. Chair, I'm going to appear rude, but I need to leave, and I just want these ladies to know that I appreciate you all coming. I wish I could hear what you have to say, but I have an appointment at 4:30. I just want you to know that I'm leaving because I have to, not because I want to. Thank you for coming.
People's in mind.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very good.
My name's Gina Pascal, and I just want to say that I've been in and out of hospitals all my life. From misdiagnosis, and I'm bipolar, and I also suffer from PTSD, and I'm also a recovering addict. And this really affects my life a great deal, because before I got diagnosed when I was a child with bipolar, I didn't know what was going on with me, and my parents didn't know what was going on with me, and I lost my mom because she never knew what was going on with her, and so she chose drugs, and she died of an overdose when I was a child, and so that was all I ever knew, was to be, if I hurt, to use drugs, and if I didn't understand what was going on, to use drugs. And so I did, from the time I was 5 years old until I turned 29 years old. And I have three children, and they saw all of it. And because of all of that, they saw the domestic violence and everything that came along with it. Once I realized that my mental health issues, that I needed to get help with it, and I knew that if I didn't, I would end up dead, because I was going to keep using drugs to be able to not have to feel the pain of what was going on inside my head and in my heart. Once I realized that I wanted to change all of that, you know, I believe that I prayed to God to help save my life, for one. And I believe that he brought me to Project Network for another, because I truly know in my heart that if it wasn't for the women that are the counselors there that helped me through the last year of my life, I would have died. And I would have left my children without a mother. At Project Network, I learned how to love myself, because I never left myself all my life. I learned that I was a valuable human being, and I could be a good mother to my children. My children now see their mom in a completely different light. And I just want to say that I know you guys have a very difficult job in trying to figure out where the money's going to come from to be able to help with the medications and stuff that we need to be able to stay sane, you know, to be able to feel like we're normal people. But if we don't have that kind of money, there's going to be a lot of people out there that are going to go out and go back to using drugs, and their children are going to be affected because their parents won't be there. They'll be either in prison or they'll be dead. And in Project Network, I learned parenting skills, because I never knew parenting skills. My parenting skills with my children were to pawn them off on other people, because I didn't know how to handle the pressures of everyday life. Now my kids are happy to be around me. You know, my kids are happy to say, that's my mom, instead of their friends saying, who is that? And they say, I don't know. You know, and I'm proud that they're proud of me, but I know that if it wasn't for Project Network and the resources that they offer, and the referrals that they give you to mental health doctors to be able to get your prescriptions and to be able to take the classes on domestic violence and anger management and everything, to learn how to be able to live life, because I never knew how to live life. I knew how to try to kill myself, but I never knew how to live life. And today I can honestly say that I know how to live life today. I don't have to run from my problems. I can face them, and I'm not afraid to tell people anymore that I'm bipolar and that I'm a recovering addict, because if people don't know that, then they won't understand the pain that I've gone through and how far I've came. So I just want to say that I know your guys' job is very hard, but I know that there's a lot more people out there in the community that have the same story as me. They just couldn't come down to Salem and tell you guys all of this. And as soon as I heard that my peers were coming down here, I begged them to let me come down, because I'm not inpatient anymore. I'm outpatient. And I live in their transitional housing. I did 6-7 months inpatient, and now I'm doing outpatient. And because of this program, February 22nd, I celebrated a year clean, you know. And thank you. I want to say that it's been one of the most difficult years of my life, but it's also been the most rewarding, because I had to fight tooth and nail for me to be able to stay sane and say, okay, I'm going to take this medication, or I'm going to take this medication, or I'm going to do what these people tell me to do, you know. And because of all of that, I can be a productive member of society. I can go out and look for a job today and not be afraid that, you know, I'm hearing people talking about me when they're not saying something to me or something like that, you know. So,
Gina, now you are OHP standard, because
right.
Your kids are not with you. You
right.
don't have
my
custody
children,
of them.
Right. My children live with their fathers, because I was actually fortunate enough to know that my son's dad, seeing that it would be a really hard struggle for me to be able to try to get clean with my kids with me. Originally, when I had went to Project Network, I came there on my own. I had asked the place that I was at before, which was an outpatient service, to get me into an inpatient, because I have a six-year-old who I wanted to have there with me, but circumstances came up where she couldn't come and be there with me. And, you know, at first I was mad about the fact that I couldn't have my kids with me, but I know now that if I would have had my kids with me, I don't think I could have worked on all the deep issues that I had to work on for myself. My kids are involved in my life, and I see them all the time. Matter of fact, my son's at home right now. But, I see the women that come in there with their children, and they, you know, the children are really blessed there. Project Network has an excellent children classes, daycare placement, and everything like that. And they also have an excellent counselors that work way beyond the call of duty. They are there for us at every chance, you know, and they give 120% every time that they're there with us, you know. And I can say that I'm grateful for them. Very grateful.
I think one thing that people don't realize is that if a woman comes in and the state has custody of her child and the child isn't even there physically, she becomes OHP standard. And it's a real catch-22, because without being able to get all the services, you know, it's hard to get your children back. And this is a dilemma that is we're now seeing. And, you know, I think you would have been in this dilemma if you had come earlier. You know,
right. When it all came about that all the cuts were being made, you know, it came about that that I would be one of those people that's affected, because I didn't have my child there, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to get outpatient treatment service, because I am a single person instead of, you know, with my children with me. But I think that if those services aren't there, I really feel like there's going to be a lot of women and men that are going to be either in the prison system create or, you know, on the streets committing some serious crimes, or they're going to be dead. And, you know, it's something that I pray about on a daily basis, because I know that there's a higher power that's greater than myself that got me clean. And so I know that somehow or another he's going to be able to help fix the situation, or be able to touch somebody's heart to be able to find the money somehow, you know.
I'd just like to add one more thing. With the services that go along where I'm at, You know, I do a lot of community service in processing and prepping myself to get ready to go back to work and stuff like that. And so I wouldn't want to look at this as like just a handout, you know, because I do a lot of work. I do a lot of escorting other clients to different appointments and stuff like that. And I do a lot of even clean rooms because they don't have the money, you know what I mean, just to keep the operations of the place going right, you know. So I try to contribute whatever I can contribute back, you know, because that's how much I appreciate how far I've gone with this place here, you know. I just can't imagine not having it around, really, for because there's so many more that need some help, you know. And I just really, you know, I don't know what I would do. I have a daughter sitting at home now, too, who's mentally disabled. And she was just learning to go catch the bus and get ready to get her a job. And now she's sitting at home. So, you know, I'm just really hoping that things turn change around and that you guys find some kind of cut somewhere else that, you know, yeah.
How do you go about, I just want to know, how do you go about making the decisions on who's going to get this money and who's going to get that money? Can you tell me, please?
Yeah, tell me, too.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Are we adjourned now?
Honestly.
Fair question.
And when I give you the one-word answer back, I'll expand on it. Okay. But in this session, it's painfully. We are, I think, very cognizant of some of the impacts, some of the programs that are going to be eliminated or cut back, scaled back, reduced. This is an incredibly difficult, I appreciate your understanding of that, and I'll express that, process that we're going through. And let me maybe put this in perspective a little bit for you. I mean, this is a revenue shortfall. I don't want to go into tax structures and how we got here. But of all of the 50 states, Oregon is impacted worse than any other state except Alaska. Even, you know, you hear about all the woes of California. I mean, they're down 11% of their projected revenues. We're down 19. And the, you know, maybe a little bit better perspective, Washington, neighbor of the north, twice as big as we are, twice the general fund, and they're down $1 billion. Oregon, half the size, half the general fund, is down $2 billion.
So what is we as the people, what can we do then?
Just exactly what you're doing. Exactly. There is nothing more meaningful to us, and no slam on David who testified earlier. But you ladies gave powerful testimony. Now, Dave gave... We get Dave's kind of testimony, and that's valuable, too. You know, we get that all the time. I mean, you know, part of us, if you will, the government, whatever that means. Even though, I mean, every one of us on this dais firmly believes of the people, by the people, for the people. I mean, so you are the government, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see Bob in the halls, and we'll be able to catch in between committee meetings. What you can do is exactly what you're doing. The other thing is, I mean, who's your senator? Who are your two reps? You've each got one and two. Call them. This is a squeaky wheel process. At the end of the day, this is a squeaky wheel process.
And don't forget the man in the middle, the governor.
Who? The chief bowler?
Yes.
He went bowling with a bunch of us last night, and I really appreciate his outreach and accessibility. But that's what you can do, and it has to be a consistent and even-handed, even-pressured. I mean, you can't be so
passionate and so, you know, you can't be smothering in it. You got to be, you know. Well, you know, but it's got to be over a long period of time.
That's the assertive is the term, not aggressive. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Politely assertive, yeah. And it's just not okay. You testify, boy. I've done my thing. I hope they do the right thing. You're not done.
Okay.
So that's, I mean, that's the best answer I can give you. We're a long way from being out of these woods. I mean, we might get, in fact, I'll say it, I think, more accurately, although nobody knows, including the state economist, we're going to get another revenue forecast come May 15th, which is probably going to bring us more bad news.
Yeah.
So this problem, you know, is not getting better.
Can I add a word as well?
Sure.
You know, the other thing is that there's a lot of work to do at home. We had a ballot measure on the ballot that would have helped a bit. It wouldn't have saved us, but it would have helped. And some of the people around here were in favor of it, and some of the people here were against it. The fact is, 55% of the people in the state voted against that. And that means that when those kind of things happen, and we might have another revenue measure after we're done here, or we might not, but if we do, and you really believe it, you need to get out on the streets and talk to everybody in your neighborhood. I mean, the sense is the folks in this building get a feeling that nobody wants to raise taxes when we had in front of us a very mild temporary tax increase, and 55% of the people in the state voted against it. So I think there's work in this building, but I'll bet not everybody in your neighborhood voted in favor of that, and not everybody where you work voted in favor of that. And I mean, I think there's work to do at home as well, because sometimes it's about raising taxes, and sometimes it's about cutting budgets. And when a measure like that loses, it becomes about cutting budgets. And, you know, there's nothing very good to cut in the budget. There's education, there's services for folks like you, there's services for the elderly, there's crime labs to keep the streets safe. I mean, there's nothing left.
But they're constantly building on that max line, and it's money for the max and stuff, but how come there's not money for the children and for us?
Because that comes from a different place. That mostly comes from the federal government. Almost all of the max money came from the federal government.
Okay. But aren't we all one? The government, federal, state?
No, we're not all one.
We have silos.
We're
okay,
not all one.
I've got to hold on a second. Representative Anderson.
Okay. I'm not new at this.
You might pull your mic in a little bit there, too.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm new at this, and so is Representative Greenlee. Can I agree with some of the things he says? But I think it goes a lot into a different vein as well, and some of you have really touched on that. We are going to be working hard to put the monies that we do have, and they're not enough, into the places that they're going to do the most help, where they'll restore a life, like you've very eloquently told us, that you're not at the place where you were a year or two, 5 years ago. You're different people. You're mothers that want to be mothers and are proud to be mothers. That's where we want to go. And you can't buy that with money. What we need, I think, is to look beyond the money. And yes, we'll try and get the money. We'll try and get the money to the place where the most desperate need it. You may not be the most desperate. You may feel like you are. But there's some elderly people that may even be more desperate than you. We've got to deal with them, too. But what I really want to say, and I don't really know how I want to say it, is that you're the answer, and we're the answer, at changing the spirit in America. In changing it away from drugs, in changing it away from, not the good drugs, but
right.
The bad drugs.
I understand completely.
We need to get people, families. We need to get single moms. We need to get families with fathers. We need to get kids working with their families so that they're not rejecting and turning away from their families like you may have been forced to.
Right.
But you're pulling into a family and working as a group. And I heard from, I think, two or three of you that there's a force outside of you that helped you make that break. That's where America started. we started with a faith that said there's a power bigger than us that can help us when we really get down to the bottom. And you may think that we look like we haven't got any problems. You know, we have the same family problems probably that you do. We may not have made the same choices you do. But we need to get back to the place where if you want to accept a higher being, I personally do. If you want to just try and do it on your own or through Legacy or through any other group, that's wonderful. But we need to get to the place where we're all helping each other. And I can't tell you how much I've been struggling with this. America is a very generous nation. We've given billions of dollars to people. And at some point, I think if we're ever going to be the nation we were meant to be, the melting pot of the world, coming together and working together, it's going to be because people like you tell your kids, we want to be something different in the future. And then you work out into your neighborhood and tell people, look what's happened to me. Look at the different me that's here today that wasn't here 5 years ago. And that's powerful. The more we can communicate that, you can't buy it with money. Yes, we'll invest the money. But we need you. We need you going out there and being the missionaries for families and for health and for mental strength that we can't possibly buy with just billions of dollars. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for having us.
How can we get that? I bet you if we put that ministry back on the ballot, I bet you it would be a different outcome. I just kind of had a feeling. Because I don't think maybe a whole lot of people understood the real effect that this would bring upon. And I'm just thinking that how long would it take for this to come back up?
Well, let me answer. You do have a local one in Multnomah County. And just as exactly as Representative Greenlich mentioned, you can get involved. I see you guys, there's three of you sitting here, but you got a peer support back here, and you are all, I can tell, you're all working together to help each other. You know, and we have to also do part of that. I mean, you lost your mother because she was probably undiagnosed.
She was. There's several people in my family that are diagnosed, but she was one that was undiagnosed.
And had she had the health care treatment, which you need to continue, the health care treatment, and that's why we need to continue this plan, you know, is in covering you. Without that treatment, then people go and do things that they shouldn't do. And I'm glad to see not only you're getting the treatment, but you're also getting peer support. And your being here also gives us some support, too, in working on that. And I'm really glad you're here. And, I'm sorry about your past and that, you know, you had to go through traumas. But everybody does, and I'm glad that you're now at a point where you can move beyond that, and that's great. But we have to provide the safety net. And
talk about the short term and the long term. I think that was your question.
Yeah, it's the short term is the Multnomah County proposal.
Okay.
Because they're going to try to backfill where we haven't been able to on the short term. We're going to still have to work here to try to fill the 150,000 people in Oregon that basically are in your same standard, OHP standard population. And any help you can do in that, in letting people know, and it's not just people in your district, but this key decision makers like the governor, like the Speaker of the House, like the President of the Senate, you know, a little story of your life to them and where, you know, that you've found a way now. And the OHP was part of that.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't the only part in that. I mean, if you took and valued the support and like you're doing volunteer hours, if you added all that up and counted it, I mean, the amount we put into it is small. But it is a very important part,
right.
And without that part, some of the rest falls apart. So, just keep up the good work and do what you can locally, too.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hold on. Question for Jean.
Yeah.
Is it Jean or Jeannie?
Jeannie, I prefer.
Question for Jeannie. You guys have been going 14 years. How many graduates have you had out of Project Network?
Well, let's see. I mean, we have two graduations a year, probably, you know, about 8 to 10 people at each graduation. You know, we probably serve, well, let's see. We serve about 24 families in residence and about 15 out. But, you know, I can't say that everybody stays clean.
That's a question I asked. I didn't have to do math. I just said, you know, okay.
Right.
I mean,
about 8 to 10. But unless we develop a job program to get felons back to work, you know, that it keeps recycling. So, yeah, we do about, I guess, 16 to 20 a year. And that's an increase from when we started. But the thing is, you need then to have housing, jobs, all those other things, which is also very hard, you know, especially if you have a criminal record. So we're looking for funding for that, too. But, yeah, so.
Let me put something else in perspective, not only for you, but everyone in the audience. And
oh, yeah.
We do a lot of talking in millions and billions around here, and you almost roll it off in the same sentence and they become kind of the same. There's a huge difference between $1 million and $1 billion. If I had a stack of $100 bills pressed between my hands as tough tight as I could, that'd be $1 million. About 3 feet. But $1 billion is a stack of $100 bills compressed as tight as you could get it. It's as tall as the Empire State Building.
Oh, my goodness.
Twice. Mm. It's half a mile.
Mm.
3 feet versus half a mile. And that's, you know, so we're down, you know, a mile worth $100 bills.
What about that place that'd be printing up money? Don't you guys have money?
That's the federal government.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your very powerful testimony. We have one more question?
Well, yes, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that you're on OHP standard. Are other people in the program on OHP Plus, and does that translate directly into the funding for your program? Is through people's individual health care coverage, or what's the connection between the budgets we're considering and the survival of your program?
Right. Well, I guess we have about half of the women with their children on OHP Plus, or maybe on SSI or some kind of disability, and then the other half mostly come from corrections, and these are the folks that are OHP standard. And, you know, for us, you know, we could move to serving all women and children and maybe survive, but for us to really serve a continuum of African American women, I mean, I know one woman that's an outpatient now that's pregnant, but thank God we got her, you know, before she got pregnant, because she's going to have a healthy baby now. So, you know, yes, we could probably, you know, pretend OHP standard people didn't exist, but, you know, I think that's really just closing your eyes. So, I mean, right now it's a 50-50 split, but that means we have lost, not just because of OHP standard, but because of residential bed cuts, you know, we've lost a third to a quarter of our budget. So, you know, if you don't have kids, you probably, you know, aren't going to have as high a priority in getting in. And it's horrible to think like that, because we know we have been so successful being able to treat single women, pregnant women, women with children, women who have gotten their children taken away, the whole spectrum.
Mm-hmm. and then on top of that, you've got, I mean, a whole another category and issue, the medically needy. And Helen, wherever you are, I got your note. The Representative Cruz.
Yeah, I heard a lot of, in the testimony, a lot of 12-step, and, you know, we understand this. 10 days ago, I celebrated 17 years clean and sober, so.
Congratulations.
So, and the only reason I bring that up is, you know, and I'm not the only one in the body that has reinvented themselves, you might say. So you know, there's an understanding here, and I just want you to know that you know, we're going to do everything we can to put what we have where it does the most good. But 12-step programs and a lot of community efforts are going to have to fill some of the gap. And you know, I don't think we can look to government to be the total solution, nor should we, because I know for myself, the fellowship is what made it for me.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. Thank you
very much.
Any other business come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.